Welcome to Trent Voices, the Trent University Alumni Affairs Show on Trent Radio. I'm your host, Donald Fraser of Alumni Affairs. It is Tuesday, April the 4th, and this is episode 34. Many of you will recognize the work of our guest today, even if you don't recognize him. Jim Maxwell has been making waves in the field of Hollywood matte painting, a task that is often unknown to the public, but is vital to the film production business. And if you don't know what matte painting is, don't worry, we're going to walk you through it. Suffice it to say that a good deal of the backgrounds that you see in mainstream movies, from complex sci-fi movies to what looks like simple romantic comedies, well, they're created by folks like Jim. Jim, though, has made some very noticeable backgrounds, from recreating the Vatican in the Borgias to sweeping panoramas of floating armadas in the Vikings. And he's received big-time recognition for his work, with a nod from the Emmy Awards for the Borgias in 2012, and then two more nominations for his work on Vikings in 2013 and 2014. He won a Canadian Screen Award in 2014 for his work on Vikings, and then another one in 2015. And those of you who are longtime Trent Radio listeners, well, you might remember that Jim had a show here in the early 1990s, teaming up with bandmate Brent Santon for Celtic Music Phenomena. And speaking of both bands and Celtic music, you'd have to be living under a rock, under a Peterborough rock, in the early 1990s if you hadn't heard of the Spleen Bishops. The Spleen Bishops, yes, their Celtic music stylings made them a household and a pubhold name around these parts. Now, when we first tried this interview earlier today, we had some technical issues on the phone line, so the following is an abridged version of our conversation. I really do hope that you enjoy it. Okay, Jim Maxwell, can you hear me?
I can.
Oh my goodness, we've had some terrible technical difficulties here at Trent Radio, which is probably nothing new for you, because you're an old Trent Radio guy yourself, aren't you?
That's true. I caused many technical difficulties back in the day.
I'd like to think that it wasn't human powered this time. There was a ghost in the machine.
Oh, I see. Well, we're connected now.
We're connected now. And I gave a bit of a background for you. I pointed out that you were a matte painter, although I didn't go into any details. I brought up the Borgias and the Vatican, but I didn't tell anyone what a matte painter actually was.
The definition of it's changed over the years, especially with the digital realm, but it's essentially someone that creates an environment that would be too costly, prohibitive for like a film's budget or a television show's budget. So like I always use, like I've done some teaching in matte painting, and I always use the example of like building a set for a castle, like a medieval castle in a movie. You know, in the 1950s or 60s, they'd do this where they'd have a sheet of glass and they would put it in front of the camera, and the castle set would only be built maybe 8 feet up off the ground. And an artist would paint the rest of it, so extend the architecture of the castle and maybe even change the sky in that. And from the view of the camera looking through the eyepiece, everything would link up. So you'd be looking at people walking below a big giant castle and a giant vista. So it's the same principle that continues today, except everything's done digitally as opposed to with paint and glass and film cameras.
It's funny, in the past we had a conversation and we talked about the Star Wars movie, the original Star Wars movie.
Yeah.
And you pointed out that, well, these were all hand painted
yes,
by guys who were probably getting paid in pizza and beer.
Yeah.
And so other than you know, the pay rate, how would things be different at say Industrial Light and Magic at Lucasfilms than in 2014 or 2016 rather than back in 1974?
I think things are a little more tried and true now, and there's almost this, you know, with the exception I think of like creating lifelike human beings and expressions and things like that, everything can now pretty much be created digitally and move. You know, you could have a 360-degree move around an object or a car or an environment with trees and that kind of thing, and it looks completely believable. Back in the day, you know, even in the 30s and 40s, when you'd have matte paintings and every other kind of practical effect you can imagine, like in say, The Wizard of Oz, you would have people, artists, and technicians basically trying things for the first time. And you can usually tell when you look back at old movies what worked and what didn't, but there's probably a lot of stuff that's invisible that you don't even know is there because it worked so well. I mean, I think Orson Welles was like incredible in terms of his productions and production techniques of special effects and special visual effects. But it's funny that you bring up Industrial Light and Magic Lucasfilm because the Star Wars movie, The Force Awakens, had just come out. And I talked to a friend of mine, and we had both worked there a few years back. I worked there in 2009, 2010, and everyone just seems dead. Like, everyone in the matte painting department just seems completely exhausted. And the matte painting department's changed now. It's not just sort of painting environments. It's painting things like the side of a Transformer's foot and spending, like, a month trying to get, like, textures and things like that right. So it's become a really, I mean, depending on who the artist is, there's a lot of different areas for the artists to be working. And sometimes people get onto sort of the most mundane thing possible. And I think with a certain amount of seniority, those that have been there the longest get to work on maybe the more vista shots and things like that. But generally after that film, I think everyone was just completely knackered and exhausted from the whole process. But now the film looked good.
It looked great. Well, but so does the work that you do. And you talk about vistas. Now, in the intro, I brought up the fact that you did matte painting for both the Borgias and for Vikings. And I remember looking at this one piece that you did, which was formerly a just kind of an empty valley. And then by the time you were done with it, there was a full river. There was a huge armada of Viking ships. It was completely and utterly different. Now, how the heck do you do that?
I mean, there's so many people involved. We're on season 4 of Vikings right now. I'm actually in the office right now in a separate room while everyone's working away, but there's got to be at least, I think, 60 people on the show.
Wow.
From all different departments, whether that's like building models of the Viking boats, people who are lighting those boats to make them, you know, react to the sunlight that was shot on location. You have people building things. You have people compositing things, compositing all the elements together. Rotoscoping, if you ever heard that term, it's basically cutting people out so that things can be put in behind them. So if we're changing the environment, there's someone who specifically has a job to frame by frame cut out the people in the foreground so that you can change the background. It's funny, you know, the funny thing about Vikings, like my job on it, my role is to make, I think I said this to you before, but make Ireland, where they shoot the show, look like Scandinavia or Norway or France. And if you see mountains or fjords, those are map painted elements using, you know, photographical elements, of course, because we're using mostly Adobe Photoshop combined with compositing software. But I mean, anything you see in that show that has mountains or fjords will be map painted. And there's a funny story someone at work told me about checking up on forums, you know, which is a fun thing to do sometimes. And people go on the Vikings, I guess it's fan forums, and there are people who've gone to look for the locations, like where, you know, where the television show's been shot. And the funny thing is they won't ever be able to necessarily be appeased because they're never going to see the vista or the background that you see in the show because there's so much augmentation going on. And even the Viking village where they shot that in Ireland, that location itself, like the physical location, has changed. So they've had to move location, but we have to still make that look like the same place, if you understand what I'm saying.
Yeah, so you're making new old worlds.
Yes.
And in fact, you've made other new old worlds as well. You've made the Vatican.
Yes, yeah. I mean, that was a lot of fun. That was shot in Hungary, and Doug Campbell, the visual effects supervisor at the time, he was up on a big giant crane, and you know, instead of the director of photography shooting, it said, "Well, this is a pretty big visual effects shot, so why don't you just go shoot it?" So they let him shoot it. He ended up winning an Emmy on Game of Thrones, actually, just recently. So he shot that scene, and you know, I had help with some 3D geometry. Someone built a very rough model, and then I just painted it all up, gave it to the compositor. The compositor composited the Vatican back into the shot, and there we went. You know, sometimes you don't always get a lot of artistic license, but in that case, I was able to, you know, put an extra rooftop here or there, or buildings that looked, you know, similar to sort of buildings from the 1500s, and just stick them in the background where I wanted, and I made up the, you know, the background, what was probably, like, shot in Tuscany or something like that, but, you know, if it looks like Italy, it'll work, I guess, was the kind of mentality on the show, and the turnaround is really quick on all these shots. We have to make it look as good as possible in such a small amount of time.
And obviously it's working because there's a whole heap of awards that you've won. You got Emmy nominations for the Borgias in 2012. Two more for your work on Vikings in 13 and 14, and a couple of Canadian Screen Awards.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun.
How's that feel? What's it like to go to one of those big posh black tie affairs?
Yeah, exactly. It's fun. There's a lot of drinking that goes on, you know, a lot of celebration, a lot of smiling faces. It's great. I mean, you know, and it's great to have things, you know, on the top of a bookshelf. At the same rate, like, the years go on, and you got to, like, kind of keep doing something and keep, you know, maintaining that whatever you're doing is relevant, right?
Yeah.
Because, you know, I'm not comfortable with, if I ever sit back and I'm just kind of like, well, I can just say, you know, I won these two awards and just kind of bum my way through life or whatever. Like, I have to keep kind of working and I guess, you know, hitting the mark and actually trying to improve on my skill set and improve on what I do. So I never get to sort of sit back. I'm sure this is the same for anyone that has any kind of success in any field, that you got to kind of keep going. So, I mean, that's what keeps it alive for me anyway.
I
feel proud, sure.
Oh, and you should. I mean, they don't just give them out to anybody.
No, I suppose not.
It's funny, you slipped in the word drinking and you know, alarm bells went off, because when I think of the early 90s at Trent University and I think of drinking, well, I think of the Spleen Bishops, man.
Yes, well, yeah. Yeah, I mean, yeah.
You guys were a Celtic music phenomena, but you were also not just household names, but pub hold names. You were a regular feature on both the pub and club scene. Tell me a little bit. Let's go back in time, and we'll do some nostalgic time. Tell
sure.
me a bit about the Spleen Bishops back in the 1990s and what you guys were all about.
Well, Brent Sand and I grew up in Brampton, Ontario, Bramley, and we always wanted to be in a band. Brent went to Trent before I did. I came the next year, and then. And we knew as soon as we started, and we were at Peter Robinson College, as soon as we were at school together, we knew that we were going to start a band. I mean, there was nothing to it. Like, we knew we were going to, you know, try to do good at school and all that stuff, but we really desperately wanted to do this band. And we, you know, we met John Bishop and we met Chris McNally, and they brought along Bobby Joe LaPlante, and there was Tunde Ishtok, and we just put it together. And I think at the time, like, the Pogues, for instance, had just sort of, they kind of made it big in that subculture, you know, all through Europe, all around the world. And, you know, there were bands like Spirit of the West that we were sort of tuning into. And I don't think a lot of people at the time knew a lot about the music. And, you know, Brent has sort of Cape Breton ancestry. I was born in Scotland and grew up listening to, like, a lot of traditional songs, you know, Ryan's Fancy from the East Coast and things like that. And we had all these songs, like, we knew all these songs and we learned them. And then we put them together with the band and did an arrangement. And I think one of our first gigs was at the Commoner or something like that. I don't know, is the Commoner still there?
No, the Commoner, unfortunately, it went by the wayside a couple of decades ago. We're getting old, Jim.
What's that?
We're getting old.
I know. But that was the first time I think we ever played anywhere maybe it was the Trend. I think it might have been the Trend was our first show, but we were nervous as anything, but, like, people were so receptive to it, and it seemed like this new phenomenon, right? This new music that no one, if they didn't have that kind of background, had never heard about. You know, it was aggressive, and it was, like, definitely kind of drinking music and a lot of fun, and people got up and danced, even if they didn't know how to dance, and we just had so much fun with it.
It was remarkable. If you went to a Spleen Bishop show in the 90s, it was almost like going to a punk show. Because people they went all out. They were dancing like crazy. They were throwing tea bags at you too at one point, weren't they?
I don't think I got hit. I think John Bishop might have got hit. So, yeah, no, I think we I'm sure the record must be broken by now, but like the underdog under the Red Dog, we broke the record for the amount of 20 cases of 24 sold in an evening. I don't know how many it was. I want to guess like there were 30 cases sold or something insane, but I just remember like playing there and it would just be a wall of people. And that was like a narrow bar. I mean,
it
wasn't quite a bowling alley, but it was kind of like if we wanted to get off stage and take a break and go have a drink, we couldn't move because it was just wall to wall people. I'm sure it was like illegally past their occupancy limit.
It was the '90s. I think they turned a blind eye at that point.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, but we went through a few different iterations. Cam, is it Warner? Was his last name?
Yeah, Cam Warner. Yeah,
it came on, and Aaron. I want to say McDonald, but I can't remember her name, her last name. Because I'm getting old, and we went through different iterations, and eventually went our separate ways. And you know, I played in some pop bands in Toronto and stuff like that. But the funny thing is, after my visit to Trent, I just like started contacting everyone. And between Brent and I, we managed to get hold of everyone, and we decided if there was ever an opportunity for it, we'd definitely do a reunion. So.
I can make that happen. I can guarantee that I can make that happen, Jim.
Yeah, I mean, everyone would be really into it.
I think a lot of people would be into hearing it as well. And that's not all. I mean, you've got this wonderful gig doing matte painting. You're not done with music because you just had a really busy St. Patrick's Day.
Well, I mean, the past maybe eight to ten years, I've been playing with my buddy Lennon Delaney, who's a Cape Breton fiddler and singer, a songwriter, is really, really good. And, you know, for the past, I think 8 to 10 years, we've been playing, you know, every St. Patrick's Day, and then other gigs outside of that in different pubs around Toronto. And he's since moved to Kimberley, BC, though he flew out for this past year, St. Patrick's, on March 17th. So we played two gigs each. But I played, I think, 10 hours worth, which means playing and singing 10 hours worth, which is, you know, always a lot of fun. So this year I put in the practice, you know, because I don't play as much as I used to, but only just since this past gig have I started playing a lot more. So I'm now playing with a fiddle player named Carrie Fitzgerald, and she's from a family of fiddlers and step dancers, really talented stuff. They go by Everything Fits. They're from Bancroft, and the Fitzgerald family, so it's everyone in the family is really talented. So Carrie and I are playing a couple of gigs. We're playing the Overdraft Pub April 9th, Friday, April 22nd, and then we're playing the Uptown Pub at Yonge and Eglinton. I forgot how much I really enjoyed playing it. The one thing, I mean, you know yourself, you play music, and if you put the guitar aside for a while, I'm sure this happens to you as well, but like you pick it up again and suddenly you realize there are things that you never approached, or you can approach things a different way. And it's not that you've lost what you learned before. It's like you just started discovering new ways, new styles, or new approaches to playing. I don't know if that happens to you, but I noticed that this year it's happened a lot to me.
It happens to me every time I pick up a guitar, because I've got a 1-year-old now, and I think completely. First of all, I don't get to play. Second of all, I think completely different. You also think differently when it comes to art, because we're getting close to running out of time here. But I want to bring up your kid's book. I had a chance to have a glimpse at a book that you've just I think you're close to completing, or just completed a book for a completely different audience of visual art appreciators. Tell me a bit about that book.
Yeah, it's a middle grade children's novel. Takes place in a school with 120 stories, sort of the biggest elementary school in the world, and it's under threat by an evil banker who loves the architecture of the building, and the school has fallen on hard times anyway. Can't seem to pay its bills, and the bank manager's manipulating everyone in the town to try to close down this school so he can take it over and build another bank. That's basically the essence of it. I'm on like revision number 20 maybe of it, and it's like 60,000 words, and it still needs to be chopped down. I've met with some publishers about it, and it's illustrated, so it's a middle grade novel that's illustrated in pencil, and there's interest in it. I just have to keep revising until I can send it out again and get some good feedback on it. I'm also working on short stories as well, like adult short stories, and sending those out to literary journals across the city, the country, North America, and it's something I do every day. I write every day now, so I'm just trying to keep that creative side going too, because there's something really, I don't know, therapeutic, but also just satisfying about writing. I mean, you've done it yourself.
Yeah.
I think we talked about it a bit at Trent. I love reading and I love writing, so it's, you know, and you've written songs, right? Like, we could both consider ourselves songwriters to some degree, and writing fiction is just sort of an extension of that for me, so I'm really looking forward to continuing that.
Well, I do want to get back to one of your songs. We're out of time, but before I go, I'd be remiss if I didn't play a Spleen Bishop song on the way out. We're gonna play "When Will We Be Married," which I think you guys nicked from the Water Boys.
That's true, and a good nick at that. I think.
I love it. Actually, it's even more high tempo than what they had to offer.
I think it's a bit fast.
Yeah,
I love it.
Jim, thank you very much for being with us today.
You're welcome.
And you know what? When the Spleen Bishops get back together, people are going to hear about it right here first.
That sounds great.
Okay, thanks, Jim. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks again, Don.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, and so as promised, we're going to go out with "When Will We Be Married" by the one and the only Spleen Bishops. Folks, enjoy this one.
When will we be married, Molly? When will we be wed? When will we be bedded in the same bed? When will we be married, Molly? When will we be wed? When will we be bedded in the same bed? You have your eye on Johnny, then Johnny B. You have your eye on Johnny and the blind man he. You have your eye on Johnny, but you better let him be. 'Cause when you go, Molly, oh, you'll be gone with me. When will we be married, Molly? When will we be wed? When will we be bedded in the same bed? When will we be married, Molly? When will we be wed? When will we be bedded in the same bed? You have your eye on Jimmy, long Jimmy Lee. You have your eye on Jimmy and the fine man he. You have your eye on Jimmy, but you better let him be. 'Cause when you go, Molly, oh, you'll be gone with me. Oh, when will we be married, Molly? When will we be wed? When will we be bedded in the same bed? When will we be married, Molly? When will we be wed? When will we be bedded in the same bed? I made a black bow for your pretty head. When will we be married, Molly? When will we be wed? Made a black bow for your pretty head. When will we be married, Molly? When will we be wed? When will we be bedded in the same bed? When will we be married, Molly?